You're listening to Global Conversations.
Welcome to Global Conversations, everyone. My name is Paige, and I'm joined by my fellow monk colleague, Regina, today. Global Conversations is a multimedia platform which is student-led by the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. Today, we're picking up where Regina and I left off from part one of our two-part series, chatting with Monk School professor, Professor Kalmar, about the rise of populism on the world stage, as well as specifically in Hungary with the leader Viktor Orban and some of the impacts he might have on the world today and global affairs. I'm really excited to have a second part to this episode. There is lots to cover, and we're just going to dive right in with my first question for Professor Kalmar. So the next question here, I want to talk a bit more about the ideas behind Eastern Europeanism and this sense of nostalgia that we discussed earlier. So in Hungary, Orban harnesses the power of religion to unify his people under what could be called a veil of discontent surrounding immigrants and refugees. My question is, in your opinion, what is the role of Christian national ideals in the discrimination of these minority groups? Perhaps the more I learn about this topic, I find similarities between the Orban and the Trump government. I would love to hear whether you find similar characteristics between the two. I would love to hear your thoughts on the role of religion for Orban as well as on the world stage.
Okay, Paige, that is a very interesting question. I think this is one example where we cannot speak of a region, if we mean by that Central Europe or Eastern Europe. So just to preface this, we're focusing here on Hungary. Czech Republic is probably the world's most atheistic nation. And there is no rhetoric left or right in the Czech Republic to give any role to the church in government, and Czech politicians don't use religious references. Okay. Slovakia is a country of very strong Catholic traditions. So there, however, so far only some of the extreme right, and even they not so much, have utilized Christianity as a rallying cry. I haven't seen anything like that happening much in Slovakia, although some elements in Slovakia have done so. And the Slovak church, unfortunately, is fairly strong for the most part. It's divided, but it's fairly strong in the most part in supporting illiberal nationalist ideas in Slovakia, which at the moment has both a liberal democratic president and a government that really could not fairly be described as illiberal or anti-democratic. Okay, so there's no region in this, in any sense, including the religious sense. But Poland, on the other hand, a deeply Catholic nation in which the church plays a very strong political role and in which the government presents itself as defending the values of not just Christianity, but specifically the Catholic Church. So, for example, in its fight against abortion, by now, I think it's only yesterday, very recently, the Polish parliament has finally approved a law that makes abortions all but impossible, legal abortions in Poland. Hungary is neither Poland nor the Czech Republic. Viktor Orban is not a Catholic. He's from a Protestant family, and his son is an evangelical. Some people think that perhaps Orban has become an evangelical himself. I don't see any evidence of that. When Orban says Christianity, Christian values, which he does often, I read white supremacy. I have very little evidence that he has anything in mind specifically, nor does he really talk about it when he talks about Christian values, than the value of protecting a Christian people from mixing with non-Christian people. I think it would be unfair to simplify the Polish government's stand to that, but I don't think it's too much of an oversimplification about Hungary and Orban. Now, evangelical Christians are in America were the mainstay of Donald Trump. Without them, Donald Trump would never have been elected, and many of Donald Trump's policies responded to evangelical Christians. Okay, the most spectacular one, perhaps, appointments to the Supreme Court. But in Hungary, evangelical Christians, it is like everywhere in the world, an increasing group. Some of them are very right-wing nationalists, but there's also a long-established Protestant church called the Evangelical Church of the Augsburg Confession. They're not really fundamentalists, perhaps, so maybe they're not evangelical in the American sense. But this church has been very kind, at least some of its members to refugees have taken care of them and criticized the Orban government for what they see as misusing Christianity to support un-Christian policy.
Thank you so much for your answer. I find the more I'm researching this topic and learning more, I really do find the high value put on the Christian faith and Christians. And of course, as you mentioned, the role of race within that whole mix. So I really appreciate you kind of breaking down for us, especially for listeners and myself for this podcast. I find this whole topic very interesting, and I'm curious about the future and whether we're going to see other similar trends regarding religion and rising politicians. Thank you. I think the next question we have is from Regina.
So in the context of your Hungary's positionality as a member of the European Union, but seemingly very separate from the values that underpin the union and then the values that underpin Orban's leadership, how do you, as someone who studies the region, kind of conceptualize that relationship? Does it not seem like the EU is kind of turning a blind eye or appeasing Hungary, maybe so as not to incite further far right rhetoric, or is it maybe also to kind of appease the far right groups that exist within Western Europe as well, because that's also something that should be recognized, that it's not something that's, you know, outside of the European Union. This is also something that's very live within it. So how do you conceptualize that relationship? And its membership seems kind of contradictory to the values that underpin the union.
Right. So the European Union does have some official values that do include democracy and the rule of law, right? And what the Polish and Hungarian governments have done is institute many measures that do not, in the opinion of most EU members, conform to these values. And so both Poland and Hungary are actually subject to a legal process which asks them to reverse some of these measures, especially interference with the judiciary. And they're fighting back, and it's not clear yet if who will win or what the consequences will be if they lose. At the same time, there's a lot of rhetoric in Western Europe that they should just kick out Poland and Hungary, because if they don't want to play by the rules, then why are they there? Now, it's a huge question, and I don't know how much time we have to answer it, because it has so many different aspects. So if we look at it at this level and not be critical about the statement that Hungary and Poland are different from the rest, so why don't we kick them out? And so then the question is, like, why don't they kick them out? And Regina, you've already given at least one answer, which is that they're afraid of right-wing populist illiberal sentiments in their own countries. I think it's perhaps so. It is so for sure. But I don't know how important Hungary and Poland really are to people in Western Europe. So I think their governments would survive any sort of opposition from right-wing critics. It's harder for the political parties themselves, because as they compete with each other in Western Europe, they need to keep in mind that Orbán has a lot of admirers in Western Europe. Like, people in North America may not be quite aware of this, but they're very politicians of high standing in Europe, such as Matteo Salvini in Italy, Marine Le Pen in France, Geert Wilders in Holland, who are buddy-buddy with Orbán, you know, and acknowledge him as a leader, okay, and meet with him and celebrate him. Okay. Now, these people, just like Orbán, are quote-unquote against the European Union. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're against the idea. They're against the way the European Union is, and they would like to change it into what Marine Le Pen calls a Europe of nations. Okay, so it's not a movement to withdraw from Europe necessarily. It's a movement to reform Europe. I'm very glad that you raised the point that in Western Europe, there are people with sentiments that are very similar to Orbán's. And maybe not just the extremists. I mean, how did that 2015-2016 migrant crisis get solved? By the EU bribing Turkey to keep the refugees back there, in Turkey, and not let them cross into Greece. From Greece, they used to go to Macedonia, Serbia, and then to Hungary. So if the EU is okay to pay Turkey to keep the refugees, the migrants from coming to Europe, can we really be surprised that some Hungarians will argue, then why are we wrong at putting up a fence so they won't come in? Because some in Western Europe are presenting themselves as opening migrants with open arms, welcoming migrants with open arms. And it's true that what Angela Merkel did when she said, we can manage and let 1 million refugees into Germany, it's one of the most admirable acts of humanitarian statesmanship ever. Okay, but it stopped. It stopped. After that, now migrants are not welcome in the European Union. So really, Orbán's sentiments about migrants and Western Europe's sentiments about migrants are the same. So why is it that there is so much rhetoric about Central Europe or even Eastern Europe being racist and illiberal and refusing to admit migrants? Why is it that there is this kind of dichotomy, like the East is illiberal and the West is liberal, when that is at most a half-truth? And I find that there's also, that itself is a racialization. It's a complicated, unfair judgment similar to when Islamophobic people attack Muslims because Muslims oppress women. Okay, so now we have people who are, I would say, are prejudiced towards Eastern Europe, accusing Eastern Europeans of being prejudiced. There's truth in it, okay, but It's only a half truth for reasons that I explain. So when we look at Brexit, for example, it was largely motivated by dislike for Eastern Europeans. And in reality, they were Romanians and Poles, but it doesn't matter because the racialization is of all Eastern Europeans. Taking jobs away from British people, and the sentiments, the anti-Eastern European sentiment, resulted in racial violence. Okay, many migrants from Poland and Romania were set upon physically by thugs in Britain during the Brexit debate. And paradoxically, a lot of the right-wing anti-EU rhetoric in Western Europe, while it sympathizes with Orban, at the same time also wants to protect their own country from migration, even from Eastern Europe. So we see a situation where people like Salvini and Le Pen both praise Orban and want to put the borders back that would keep Eastern Europeans out. Because Orban would be happy with that. Orban would be happy with the borders coming back up and Hungarians not leaving for the West.
Yeah, your point
it's
there.
It's a very complicated situation.
Oh, yeah. No, I appreciate you trying to simplify it for the podcast, because I think a lot of listeners, you know, might be falling victim to the idea that central and that central Europe is really anomalous in this, and that they really shouldn't be separating it from, you know, the realities of Western Europe, because in a lot of cases they aren't that different.
I think that's very important. I think the right-wing liberals got lucky in some, not all, parts of Central Europe for the reasons that I tried to explain, because the effects of neoliberal globalization there are particularly strong, but they're not qualitatively different from Western Europe or North America.
Yeah, and then your comment about Western Europeans being anti-Eastern European migration was also interesting, because it reminded me of the Poland case when Poland became part of the EU in 2004. And then they saw a huge influx of Polish migrants into the UK before they left. That reminds me of that case every single time, because, you know, my mother growing up in the United Kingdom, you know, that was way back before, sorry, Mom, to age you, but to go back before 2004, she was very cognizant of the influx of Eastern Europeans. And there is a huge prejudice against that demographic, aside from right. A lot of the realities now, huge prejudice against the Roma population, against Poles. And so I think just your comment just reminded me of that, because I think I don't think people realize that there's also that element of it as well.
I think it's an extremely important element of this situation, and almost funny if it wasn't so sad, because like Romanians, for example, they insist that I heard the Romanian ambassador to the UK say this on publicly, that how important it is to him for British people to know that Romanians are not all Roma. Okay.
Yeah.
To the British, Eastern Europeans are like Roma. So it doesn't matter if you are Romanian or white Romanian.
Yeah.
Roma Romanian. So, you know, there's a kind of pecking order, a hierarchy that can be somewhat racialized in Europe that goes back a long time around sort of the west to east axis. So the, you know, sort of a hierarchy of looking down at people.
Yeah.
So Western Europeans look down historically, not so much today, on Germans. Germans look down at Slavs. But Czech and Polish Slavs look down on Russians, so it's it goes west to east.
Yeah, exactly.
A scale that can be utilized politically every now and then when the right circumstances surface.
Absolutely. We just have a couple more questions left to get through. So thank you again so much for your time. So Paige, if you want to get on with our second last question.
Yes. So my second to last question is perhaps a bit open-ended, but I'd like to kind of hone in on the topic of media and sort of what your thoughts are with the Orbán government and this sort of crackdown, perhaps like in media, and what that looks like, and what do you think the Hungarian people look to the media to find? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, as you know, Paige, Orbán has taken measures to limit the freedom of mainstream media, especially print and television in Hungary. I think listeners should understand that Hungary is not Russia. Okay, so this was not done by imprisoning journalists, certainly not by poisoning journalists. Hungary has no political prisoners. And although it has been declassified by Freedom House from free to partially free, I believe now, or maybe even lower, there's still a certain amount of freedom in Hungary, including in the media. So I religiously read a website called 444.hu, which is a very free critical resource. So internet journalism is still possible, although recently Orbán has tried to crack down on it as well. The way he cracks down things is have his friends purchase the management. It's all basically legal, perhaps corrupt, but not violent means. You know, you just buy out your enemies, you put your own people in charge, the same way that he handles the education system. Find some legal loophole, some legal language, and then get judges who you have appointed to interpret the law so as to limit the freedom of the media or of education. And I'm so glad you asked me this question, because we need to understand that this prejudice against Eastern Europeans that I mentioned, the sort of need to think of, let's say, Hungary as being more like Russia, may make us blind to the fact that those same techniques are very much the ones that Trump tried to use in the US and that could be used in a democratic country, because Orbán respects the letter, but not the spirit of the law. You know, unlike Putin, who doesn't respect the letter either. You know, anybody could be put in jail in Russia, not in Hungary. Okay, perhaps it'll happen soon, but it's not there yet. And I am not convinced that Orbán wants it to go there. I'm convinced that Orbán loves his ability to manipulate the legal system and to rise above it almost into a mocking position. So he and his friends, the Fidesz party, have manipulated the system so that there is no longer a very major critical newspaper around. There's one, but it's not as widely read as it could be. Also because the government won't put ads in papers like that. Okay, the government is selective about where it puts its advertising. Hungarian television, because of appointments made by the Fidesz government, is a spokes outlet of the Hungarian government. But there is still independent journalism and very good quality independent journalism in Hungary on the internet. You asked me about the consumers, the people. Well, of course, I mean, educated people, interested people can reach these internet sites, and they're very popular. The most popular was taken over recently by one of Orbán's friends, but 444 that I mentioned, another one, 24.hu, and many others still produce quality independent journalism that's freely available to any Hungarian. But people who are maybe less networked among those who consume this media, which would be mostly rural people, less educated people, the bedrock of support for illiberals everywhere, including in Hungary, those people are probably not seeking out these internet sites. And if they just tune into the main Hungarian television station or buy the major Hungarian newspapers, they'll consume shameless pro-Orbán propaganda.
Thank you so much. That was such an excellent answer. I can't help but feel like that answer really just continues to reinforce this really strong role that media plays for any rising government, as well as the strengthening of a government as strong as Orbán's in Hungary. And I as you mentioned, there are lots of similarities in the region, and it's really where are people looking? Where are people trying to source their information, and really what role does that have on perspectives for future governments? And I really appreciate your answer. So the next question is going to be from Regina, and I believe that's our last question. And I think we have just our last question now from Regina.
Yeah, so we just kind of wanted to end off the podcast in a way that would kind of, well, we're in a difficult position in the world right now. And I think I'm really curious about getting your opinion, zooming out from where we were looking at East Central Europe specifically. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on where you think this populist movement will go. I know that's a very open-ended question, and I know that, you know, no one knows the answer to it truly, but based on what we're seeing now, how do you see some, you know, of populist leaders' rejection of neoliberal values playing out? How do you see Orbán's continued leadership in Hungary playing out? I'm just curious about the trends that we're seeing globally, the commonalities between populist leaders, where you see that going in the future.
Well, Regina, as you know yourself, that was a very tough question, and I don't have a crystal ball, so I'm just going to make some observations and some guesses. I think that the inequalities that I started referring to, which are addressed, but in your and my opinion, improperly and falsely by illiberalism and populism, those inequalities do need to be answered. And so the question is, in what way can we answer them that will win over the hearts of those whose hearts can still be won over among the supporters of these illiberal, racialized movements? And I know that there's some interesting proposals for doing this, such as the wealth tax proposed by Thomas Piketty, which some governments are planning to try out. But I'm afraid that, although honestly, those who know me know that I'm generally an optimistic person, I can't be too optimistic about where this is going to lead. I don't see that the inequalities are being diminished. As you know, coronavirus has only increased them. Low interest rates, okay, and they will have to stay because governments have borrowed so much to deal with coronavirus that they can't afford high interest rates to pay back what they've borrowed. And low interest rates make it possible for anyone who has cash or borrowing power to basically get free money. I mean, you said, let's look at it worldwide, and situations similar in many places, but in Ontario today, you can borrow a mortgage on a house that is not much less, the rate is not much less than inflation. So basically you can get money for free to invest in something such as the stock market. As a result, the stock market is booming like crazy, and anybody who has money in the stock market is now a third richer than they were, I'm guessing. than they were before the coronavirus crisis. So the problem, it doesn't seem like we have we are solving it. Okay. So then the question is, like, can we somehow in that context foresee what's going to happen? And I don't see what's going to happen being very good. This is what I see. I see that Trump and Orban are shooting themselves in the foot through their racist, anti-migrant position, because electorally, they're excluding a large number of the electorate. Perhaps the reason in Hungary illiberalism is more popular is because they still have very few migrants. Okay, so white racist voters, white voters are the majority, and white racism can be successfully whipped up. But in a place like Ontario or much of the United States, this doesn't add up. Like, white people aren't a huge majority or won't be a huge majority for a long time. So appealing to white supremacism is not the way, I think, for right-wing populists to go if they want to continue to remain in power and to gain power. Think about the fact that a much larger number of black men voted for Trump in the last election than in the previous one, and that even in 2016, 30% of Hispanic American voters voted for Trump, even though Trump was then vocally racist about Hispanics. Okay. So why are people doing it? Because these racialized groups, like the poor and not so poor whites, they really have the same problem. They've been similarly affected by neoliberal globalism and the rising inequalities that we see in the world. Okay. And if there is an unscrupulous politician and could unite them, not the way you and I would like them to unite, which is to find fair, efficient ways to fight inequality, but instead around some kind of a nationalism, some kind of a right-wing or maybe religious agenda, okay, then I think they could be very successful. And I think this is exactly probably what is in the mind of some Republican politicians today. I think I'm afraid is the biggest danger. We saw it in Ontario several times, that people like Rob Ford, or before that Premier Mike Harris, are able to create a right-wing reactionary coalition that goes beyond white supremacists. And I'm afraid that that is like the horrible scenario that that may take place if you ask me what will happen. If you ask me what I think should happen, I think the inequalities should be immediately addressed. And I also can't really think of a better solution than a wealth tax, but a really functioning wealth tax on the very rich, and closing down the tax havens. Efficient technology for tracking tax evasion. And I think I'm going to stop there, because both we're running out of time probably, and I'm getting a bit off the topic of illiberalism in Central Europe.
No, really, no problem, Professor. I think you raised some really, really interesting points, and I know that that wasn't an easy question to answer, but I appreciate you sharing your thoughts, and also just being very, very frank about maybe, you know, your thoughts maybe not being the most positive. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes being realistic about what is going to happen in the next year is probably going to do us more good than being overly optimistic and overly hopeful. But that's, I mean, that may sound very cynical, but I think where we are right now, especially now that you know, with what happened on Capitol Hill at the beginning of January, you know, Trump no longer being in office, but his legacy still remaining incredibly strong. And also, you know, and seeing other populist waves of some sort of manifestation around the world. This is not going to be going away overnight. And I think You raise really good points about what needs to be addressed. However, things like, you know, addressing inequalities are also things that won't happen overnight. These are things that have been ingrained over generations. And I think, you know, I am in full agreement with you. It's a hard thing to understand, and it's a hard pill to swallow.
Well, I should have, you know, just to sound somewhat more optimistic, I should have. makes my heart sing is to see that there's a Bernie Sanders who I think his policies for the most part would really work, and that he has so much support among young people. So at least, you know, there's a lot of people who of all kinds who are united in knowing in which direction we'd like to go. But I'm just not sure
how successful
that is going to be.
No, I really appreciate your answer, Professor, and your candidness. So we've been recording for a bit now, so we will be closing the podcast, but we just wanted to take the time to thank you so much for having this discussion with us. While we did focus on a lot of our discussion on, the case of Hungary and the European Union, I think a lot of this discussion is very topical as well in our discussion. We've talked about how other cases, the United States and what's been going on there recently. This is not something that's, you know, anonymous to or one specific area of the world. This is something that we're seeing everywhere. And I think it's really important for us to have these discussions as us young people, you know, move into the world and graduate into careers. It's important for us to be cognizant of this information and living in an increasingly digitized world and being online, being aware of the information available to us, the disinformation that's being propagated and just being increasingly knowledgeable about what's going on. But I think that we've had a very, very good discussion, and I'm really looking forward to having the listeners tune in. Thank you so, so much for your time and for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for all the excellent questions and the chance to chat about them.
That concludes the second part of our two-part series with Professor Kalmar talking about a breakdown of populism on the world stage, and specifically the role of Viktor Orban in Hungary. I just want to say a really special thank you to Professor Kalmar for joining Regina and I today to talk about some really important issues and perhaps misconceptions on the world stage. I know Regina and I had a really great time putting this episode together, and I hope listeners enjoyed diving deep into some really important conversations about what is happening on the world stage today. I hope listeners continue to tune into Global Conversations and follow us on social media to participate in the global conversation.